Okay. Okay, Gloria, Judd, Henry, welcome, Toby, Phyllis, and we got Marina, and looks like that's Irwin 789. That's the easiest m number to remember. Okay, so thank you for waiting a few extra minutes. I was running back from the Shiva minion that we had, and now we are ready to learn some Torah. So if we recall last week, we had a line at the end of the Gemara where Rava was praising Rabbi Shimon. He basically said something, it's a little unclear what it means, and that's actually what I want to share. The line was, if you look on the Zayin Beis, which we're starting with, 17b, Rava says on the second line in the Gemara, Amar Rava, the Yalde Ime Rabbi Shimon Teilid, V'lo Lo Teilid. Now, what does that mean? There's different ways to actually read that statement. So it's basically saying a woman should have a child like Rabbi Shimon, and if not, it's not worth it. And there's a few things that are puzzling about it. But one is first just what is pshat? So if you look at Rashi, Rashi's saying, who's the person praying over here that they should have a child like the great Rabbi Shimon? Who do you think should be praying for the child? The mother? Rashi says the mother. However, the Ritva says, Rashi, I thought you're the grammarian, right? You know how we have, when you learn Chumash, you get all of the grammatical Rashis, which we, okay, I'll speak for myself. I skip over all of them. I think Ruba Deruba of everybody skips over the grammatical Rashis because in order to appreciate the grammatical Rashis, you have to understand Hebrew grammar well enough to then like appreciate what Rashi is doing and how he departs maybe from our understanding. But anyway, so Ritva gives a little bit of Musar to Rashi, so to speak. He says, no, you look, it's referring to the son. It's the son who is saying to his mother, it says Ime, to his mother, that you should have a child like Rabbi Shimon. Now, this is interesting. Why would it be the son who is praying? In fact, also, why would it be Dafka, the first son, praying or telling his mother to have a second child? Yeah, I mean, first of all, that's just a very not appropriate for the child to be making any requests of that sort to begin with. But number two, what is the lesson over here? So the Siach Yitzchak has this fascinating idea. You know, I'm not sure if it's pshat per se, but it's pretty good drush, I would say. What he points out is that the Gemara Maseches Nida on the Lamed Amid Beis tells us, you know, why does a woman need to bring a karbon when she has a child? You know, usually, you know, you're bringing a karbon like she's atoning for a sin. What did she do wrong? So we're told what happened. What happens is that a woman goes through childbirth. And this is before they had the kinds of painkillers that we have today. The what's that thing called? The one they put right into your spine, or
Epidural.
epidural. Thank you, Toby. Yes, I remember the term from 2 months ago now. We learned if you need epidural, better sooner than later because it took forever for the guy to come around. But anyway, yes. So they didn't have epidurals back then. I'm sure they had some sort of painkiller, but not to the extent we have today. And even with the epidural today, they still have to loosen it up for when the woman goes into the actual labor part. So basically, I don't need to tell you, there are mothers who are on here with us who can attest to the fact that I'm sure you would agree that it's very painful, to say the least. So what happens is a woman will cry out and she'll take a shvuah, she will take an oath saying that, you know what, I am no longer going to be bound to my husband. I'm no longer going to have any more children with him. And she basically takes an oath, a shvuah, saying that she's not going to have any more children. And so the reason she needs to atone is that when she eventually wants to have a second child, she's going to have to break her shvuah in order to have that second child. And so what is Rava saying? Rava saying is, if you're going to have a child like Rav Shimon, then it's worth it for you to break your oath. It's worth it to break a shvuah if you're going to have a stellar child like that. If you're not going to have something like Rav Shimon, then it's not really, you know, maybe you shouldn't break your oath. Because basically what he's saying is you got to hope and you got to really work to make sure that your children actualize their potential and become someone great Otherwise, you're not really justifying breaking that shvua that you made the other time after the first child. And that's why it's the second son. So the first son telling his mother, hey, by the way, make sure it's worth it if you're going to break that shvua after having me and you're going to have a second child. So that's the Siach Yitzchak's idea. Again, it might be a little bit more along the lines of Drush, but I don't have a better way of explaining this line in the Gemara. So that's the that's him based on the Ritva. Okay. End of that idea. I thought I'd open up with that only because we're going to have to get a little bit involved. So I figured we'd start off with something a little bit more fun. Basically, if we remember the Gemara from last week, which we will review, don't worry, I'm not expecting everyone to remember everything offhand. I don't remember everything we did offhand. So if we remember and we rehash what we learned last week, what we did last week was we had a series of Kal V'chomers to infer different levels of Isser that one could violate that would incur Malchus. What we're going to do on Yinzayin Amid Beis this week is we're going to present Pirchos. What's a Pircha? A Pircha is a logical hole in the Kal V'chomer. The Kal V'chomer only operates when you have something that is unequivocally more chamor, more stringent than the Kal. And then you could say, oh, if this thing, which is more lenient, has the stringency, Kal V'chomer, that stringent thing has to happen. However, if we find that there are things that make the lenient category more stringent than the stringent category, and we can't clearly identify something as this is unequivocally more lenient than B, then the Kal V'chomer falls apart. Does that make sense? Because if not, I want to make sure that's clear, because a lot of the Gemara we're doing is all based on that premise. So don't be bashful. Can I clarify that more? All right, so we know what a Kal V'chomer is. So we're doing Kal V'chomer busting, basically proving that the Kal V'chomers are not logical. That's what we're doing. So in order to disprove the Kal V'chomers, we have to remind ourselves what the Kal V'chomers were that we learned last week. So allow me to outside briefly rehash. I'm going to be glancing at the Gemara and rehashing so we remember. So as we recall, we have Bikurim. So number one, Maaser Sheni is where this all starts. Maaser Sheni, the fruits you bring up to Jerusalem during the first, second, fourth, fifth, and sixth year of the Shemitah cycle. If you eat them outside Jerusalem, you get Malchus. Now we said, so why did the Pasuk have to specify Bikurim also, that I get Malchus if I eat them outside of the walls of Jerusalem? Must be coming to teach me something else I wouldn't have known. Otherwise, it's superfluous. I could learn from Maaser Sheni through a Kal V'chomer. It's more chamor. So he said, the reason Bikurim is singled out is to teach me that if the Kohen begins to eat the first fruits before he allows the Yisrael to recite the Psukim from the Torah he's supposed to say, then the Kohen gets Malchus for that. That's Kal V'chomer number one. Kal V'chomer number two is for a Karban Todah and Shlamim offering. So why did the Pasuk have to specify a Karban and Todah that you get Malchus, you eat them outside the walls of Jerusalem? I can make a Kal V'chomer from Maaser Sheni because Karbanos are more Kadosh than Maaser Sheni. So must be coming to tell me something else that I would not have known. What would have I known? That it's usur to eat the Todah and Shlamim offering before the Zrikat Dam, before they throw the blood, which is part of the process of the offering. That's Kal V'chomer number two. Kal V'chomer number three, Bechoros. So a Bechor, why do we have to mention a Bechor in the Pasuk that you shouldn't eat it outside of Jerusalem? It's coming to teach me, rather, that a Yisrael is not allowed to eat from the Bechor even after the blood is thrown. That's Kal V'chomer number three. Kal V'chomer number four, Chatas and Asham offerings. Those are considered Kachi Kachim, which our Mishnah specified. Those are Karbanos that have a higher level of sanctity. Why do we say them in the Pasuk? Why are they singled out? I can infer from Maaser Sheni that I don't have to eat them sorry, that I can't eat them outside the walls of Yerushalayim. Must be coming, and I can make a cauliflower from all the other things that I know that I can eat before Zerika. I know I can't eat from it after the Zerika from Israel, etc., etc. Must be coming to tell me, since everything else we mentioned until now is more lenient than Chatas and Asham. Must be coming to tell me something I would not have known, that Chatas and Asham, not only can you not eat it outside the walls of your Shalayim, but you can't even eat it outside of the Beis Hamikdash. Chutz L'Klayim. And then the fifth and final Kal V'Chomer we learned was an Ola offering. The Ola is considered to a certain degree to be the most chamor category. Why? Because nobody eats from an Ola offering. It goes all up to God. And I could have derived all the previous rules through a Kal V'Chomer from all the other categories we mentioned. Why do I need to specify an Ola offering if I could infer through a Kal V'Chomer all the previous laws we just stated? Must be coming in to tell me that nobody is allowed to eat from it. And that is the final din. That's the fifth and final Kal V'Chomer that we learned last time. So again, a lot to juggle in our heads at once. But those, so now we actually mentioned the rationales for the Kal V'Chomers. Right now I didn't actually. You just took my word for it that what I told you was more kal, more lenient. And that which was more chamor, more stringent, was in fact more chamor. Nobody decided to interrogate me as to why I'm assuming one is more stringent than the other. The reason I didn't say yet is because actually, while I incorporated the reasoning into last time, the Gemara didn't actually tell us why. The Gemara just told us there's a Kal V'Chomer. It didn't tell me why one was more kal and one was more chamor. By the way, terms are down, kal, chamor, need translation required. Kal is more lenient, chamor is more stringent. I'm using those terms a lot, so you can write down if you need to. Okay, so what the Gemara is going to do now is it's actually going to tell us the rationales for the Kal V'Chomers that I incorporated into the shiur last time, because otherwise we wouldn't understand Shah and the Gemara. And now this time what we are doing is we're going to mention a rationale and then a counter-rationale that will repudiate and destroy the Kal V'Chomer. Here we go. So what happened was Rava praised Rav Shimon, and then he says, "Va'avel gav isu pircha." I think Rav Shimon's an excellent rabbi. He came up with some really great Kal V'Chomers, and he's still awesome. We still love him, but I found some holes in the Kal V'Chomers. So what are they? So right now we are on the fourth line in the Gemara. I can only imagine it's 17b to the first power. My chumra de bikurim meiser. Why did we assume that the bikurim, the first fruits, are more chamor than meiser sheni? Shechein asurim lezarim. Oh, we assume because anybody can eat meiser sheni, so it's more kal. Bikurim is more chamor, because it could only be consumed by Kohanim. That makes sense. However, Adarabba, on the contrary, Meiser Chamor, I can spin this the opposite way. Really? Meiser is more Chamor. Why? Shechein Asur La'onein. We learned this in our Chumash class actually a while back in Kisavah. We learned, So anyway, pay attention to the Parsha. So what we learned is that an onain, someone who just lost a relative, they are not permitted to eat meiser. So because they're not allowed to eat meiser, which is a quality that does not apply to bikurim, we can't just assume meiser sheni is a more lenient category. And now that we don't have a clear, indisputable kal and indisputable chamor, we lose the kal v'chomer altogether. That's number one. That's pircha number one. Pircha number two, umay chumer de toda shlamim meiser. Why do we assume that the toda and shlamim offerings are more chamor than meiser? Shechein teunim matan damim ve'murin legavim mizbeach. Because they have all these rituals associated with them of the blood and their innards being brought upon the altar. You don't do that for Meiser. Meiser is not brought upon the altar. So I would think a Todah Shlomo offering are more chamor than the Meiser Sheni. However, once again, Pircha number two, Adarava Meiser chamor Shein Ta'un Kesef Tzura. Meiser is more chamor because in the event that you want to redeem Meiser onto money, so then it would need to be on Kesef Tzura, which is basically a properly minted coin. Generally, I think the way you determine that is, like, you know, it has like the face of the governor on there. You can't just put it on any kind of coin. It have to be on a very specialized coin. That's within the laws of Meiser Sheni. However, in the event that, you know, generally we don't transfer Kedusha for Karbanos, but there are certain extenuating circumstances where I think either injuries or such occurred to the Karbanos, if I'm not mistaken, that we would then transfer the Kedusha onto something else. So point being is, Meiser Sheni is more chamor when it comes to being poda, to redeeming the sanctity onto another item. So again, you can't just assume that a Todah and Shlamim offering are more stringent. That's Kalachomer, that's a Pircha number two. Pircha number three, the third Kalachomer also doesn't make sense. Umay chumra de bechor mi toda ushlamin. Why would we assume that a bechor and toda, that a bechor is more chamor than a toda and shlamim offering? We said that a firstborn offering is more stringent than a toda and shlamim that we just discussed. What was the rationale? Why? What makes a bechor different than these other karbanos? It's not kachi kachim. Well, Shechin Kedusha so meirecha. A Bechor maybe is better or more sanctified than a standard carbon because it is imbued with Kedusha from the womb. You know, it almost reminds me of beginning of Yirmiyahu, where God says to Yirmiyahu that I've like already designated you from the womb itself. So that's the rationale. But then we reject this rationale. It's not a clear kavachomer. Adarava toda ushlamim chamurim. Toda ushlamim have an element that makes them more chamur than a bechor. Shechein to un smicha unisachim utnufas chaza v'shok. Because it requires all these special rituals of smicha, of libations, of waving different parts of the body of the animal. And therefore, that's something that you do not do for Bechoros, for the firstborn offering. And therefore, we can't just assume that, you know, it'd be very myopic of us just to see things from one direction, but not from the other direction, because there's a Chumrah on the other side as well. That's the breakdown of number four. And then let's just bring it home. My chumra. Oh, wait, did I skip one? Yeah, sorry. Number four. My mistake. Yeah, I did skip one. My chumra de chatas v'asham mi bechor. Now we assume that a chatas and asham, offerings that are meant for atonement, those are kachi kachin. Those are the higher form of kurbanos that must be eaten inside of the temple. So why do we assume that they are more chamor than a bechor, than a firstborn offering? Shechein kachin kachin, because they're classified as kachin kachin. They're classified as more sanctified. Therefore, we say they're more chamor than a bechor. However, adarabba, bechor chamor, shechein dushasa meirecha, right back at ya. The rationale that we wanted to say Bechor was more chamor than a Todah Shlamim before, well, why can't we apply it to Chatas and Asham? You assume a Chatas and Asham are more chamor than a Bechor. You want to make a Kavachomer from Bechor to Chatas and Asham, but for the same reason, a Bechor, we said in a Havamina, the Bechor is more chamor than a standard Todah Shlamim offering. It should also be greater. It should be more chamor than a Chatas and Asham offering. Because also, a Chatas and Asham are not inherently imbued with sanctity from the womb. You have to designate these animals as chatas and hashem offerings. So really, b'chor has an element that makes it more chomer than a chatas and hashem as well. So we can't just make a kal chomer from b'chor to chatas and hashem for the very rationale that the Gemara suggested initially. That's pircha number four. Then we'll do pircha number five, and we get to the end of the piece. We'll take time for questions, but hopefully this isn't too much of a whirlwind all at once. Umay chumra de ola mechatas v'asham. Why do we assume that an ola offering is more chamor than a chatas and asham offering? Shein kolel. Why? Because the ola, as we said before, it's completely consumed. It's something that no one gets the benefit from, which is it's funny. It's a little bit circular when you think about it, because that's the point we wanted to prove from the ola, that no one could eat from it. So it's an interesting point over there. But anyway, adarabba, chatas v'ashem chaniri, why would a chatas and ashem offering still be more chamor than an ola? What would make them, in theory, more sanctified than an ola offering? Think about what they do. Shechein mechapri, because they have the power to atone. They have the power to give someone a kapara for their sins. The chulu chamir me'ola. In fact, actually, right? So if you look at our pyramid, right? Let's just summarize for a second. What's our pyramid? We have Meiser Sheni. We have Bechor Todan Shlamim. We have, what was after that? Sorry, we have Todan Shlamim with Bikurim. We had, and then had Bechor. We then had Chatas and Asham, and then we had an Ola. So we assume in our pyramid here, the Ola offering was all the way on the top. That was the final step. That was the most chamor category. But you know what? We're about, you know, it's like that Yertle the Turtle, Dr. Seuss book. I know Dr. Seuss is becoming banned nowadays, but this one I don't think was banned just yet. In fact, it's about toppling power. So in fact, it might even be encouraged. So anyway, right, he gets all the way to the top of the pyramid and they make this whole tower for him. And eventually it's so tall, it falls down and he's on the bottom with everybody else. So that's exactly what happens to the Ola offering over here. We built the Ola up. What? Right. So of course, in a mushal. So now why do we, so now the Ola comes all the way crashing down to the bottom of Chulul Chamiri Me Ola. Actually, like all these things are more chamor than Ola. All these offerings, at least, are more chamor than Ola. Or the Ismu Shtei Achilos, because God gets to eat from it, and others get to eat from it. In fact, if we're looking at things from the standpoint of how much maintenance, so to speak, is there required, remember how we said that a Todah and Shlamim offering are more chamor than the things that preceded them, because they require the rituals that need to be performed along with them. So when you think about it, an Ola to a certain degree is actually more kal than the previous categories, because unlike other offerings where God eats some of it, the Kohen eats some of it, maybe the Yisrael also eats some of it, the Ola is pretty simple. You just put the, it's more to it, of course, but you throw it on the Mizbeach and it all goes up. So for the same reason, the Ola might be more chamor, it's also its Achilles heel that makes it more kal at the same time. And so we don't have an unequivocal kal v'chomer rendering Ola the great highest part of the pyramid. So the Gemara then asks, well, if all of these kal v'chomers, none of them are maintained at the end of the day. We reject all of them. So then, Elamai the Yalde Imek Rabbi Shimon. Why is Rava saying, it's like a funny thing. Rava basically eviscerates Rabbi Shimon, and he says that Rabbi Shimon's Kalvachomers are kaput. But then also, at the same time, he says, and if you want to have a child, it better be a child like Rabbi Shimon. How do we square those two statements? He just eviscerated him. He makes it seem like you wouldn't want someone like Rabbi Shimon. You're going to want a kid every time they suggest the Kal V'chomer in yeshiva, then someone's going to be like, yeah, that didn't make any sense. Get out of the classroom. So rather, Ravis, so th- and this is a very, very important point, actually. When we determine who is, you know, remember we had a Monday night shiur about who's a Talmud Chacham. So there's really two components to being a Talmud, well, a number of components beyond what I'm about to say. But the Gemara talks about this. I think I'm remembering Maseches Tainis, it comes up, but I believe in other places as well, where they say it's one thing if a rabbi forgets a halacha or was not aware of a particular halacha, but it's a worse thing if their logic is flawed, actually. So if someone's logic is flawed, because if I'm missing data, so you know what I do? I missed that Mishnah Berurah over there. Let me incorporate it into my body of knowledge, and now I know what to do with it. But if someone doesn't know, someone can have a lot of data, but they don't know how to process the data properly, then it can lead to all sorts of terrible conclusions. It's like we talked about. You know, if you you could hear about concepts like Bikuach Nefesh or Kavod Habrios, but if you don't understand the parameters of it, how to apply it methodically, then it can lead you anywhere, basically. So what's Rava say? What's Rabbi Shimon's saving grace? Yes, he may have made a mistake here and there, but the mind is really the day, Misaris Leila Kravidarishle. What Rava said was there was a saving grace here. That what he did was he actually darshaned the pasuk out of order. If you look back at the Torah Hashem and Yitzayim and Aleph, and actually it's not on our page. You go back one page, you see the order of the pasuk. The order of the pasuk is not the same order of the items that we put in the Kal Vachomer. So Rav is saying is, yes, it's possible that Rabbi Shimon didn't consider from certain angles, but he had a certain aptitude, a certain skill for being able to look at a pasuk, reconfigure it and reorder it, and then explain it in a way that is relatively understandable. Because we went in the order of what? We went like Meiser, Bikurim, Toda Shlamim, Bechor, Chatas Asham, Ola. That's not the order that they are found in the pasuk. So what he did was he mixed up the order in a way that it could come out with a clear set of Kal Vachomers. Yeah, we proved him wrong in the end, but that's some very brilliant thinking on his part that he even got to that point. That is what Rava was saying. That brings us to the end of this part of the Gemara. So let me just pause for one moment. Are there any questions about the Pirchas of the Kal Vachomer? I realize, you know, it may have been a little bit wiser for me rather than go through all five in one shot and then ask any questions. Maybe I should pause after each one and ask if there are any questions, because how can I expect even myself to remember all five at the same time? So, but any thoughts or insights? Henry wants to talk more about Dr. Seuss, I know. Okay. All right. He's like, don't bring Dr. Seuss into our Gemara here. All right. Okay. So the Gemara is going to bring back an old friend of ours, a concept that we learned a while ago. Remember, we learned there's a concept of Ein Maskir Min HaDin and Ein Onshin Min HaDin. So a little bit of background just to remind ourselves. In order to get Malkus, in order to get like a punishment in the Torah, generally there needs to be an Ashara and needs to be a mentioning of an Onesh as well. If you want to get like specific punishments. So what happens is that you'll need a pasuk that warns you not to do something, says don't do X, and another pasuk, which is the Onesh, it says here's the punishment you incur in the event that you commit X. So what we learned is that there's a punishment for someone who commits incest. Now the psukim say if someone sleeps with his paternal sister or his maternal sister, but doesn't explicitly say with his full sister. And so we ask, wait a minute, can I just make a Kal Vachomer? Kal Vachomer, if I'm going to get punished for committing incest with my half-sister on my mother's side or from my father, Kal Vachomer, I should get punished for committing incest with my full sister. But nonetheless, we say you can't make a Kal Vachomer to impose a punishment on somebody. Now, the logic in that, I think there's multiple approaches, but memory serves. Part of the logic to that is that once you get Malkus, once you get put to death, And then imagine, right? Like what we just did tonight. What did we just do tonight? We had five Kavachomers and we eviscerated all of them and threw them out the window. So imagine you make a Kavachomer and then you give someone Malkus, or you even put someone to death on the basis of that Kavachomer. And then someone like Rava comes along and says, yeah, you know, that Kavachomer, you can really think of the issue from another angle and your Kavachomer falls apart. It doesn't make any sense. So, you can't bring the guy back to life now. I mean, okay, maybe some of the Rabbanim in the Gemara were capable of doing that, but once you kill a guy, you can't undo it. So the Gemara brings in this question, V'chi masir min adin, can I derive an ashara to get Malkus through a Kavachomer? Meaning, even if these Kavachomers were legitimate Kavachomers, even if we didn't have all these Pirchas, what was the Havamina? What were we thinking initially to suggest that I could derive Malkus through a Kavachomer? You can't do that. And Afilamandor or Ochman, and even we say we can infer punishments through a Kavachomer, Imat Sirmanadin, we can't learn the initial Isser through a Kavachomer. So I can't infer from one to the other, if in Meiser Sheni, it says that I have to eat it inside Yerushalayim, Kavachomer for everything else that we just talked about. I can't even assume that. No, rather the Pasuk needed to explicate every single category of all the different karbanos that we talked about. Why? Because otherwise I wouldn't know that the stricture of eating it within the Jerusalem was applicable. That's what, because otherwise I can't do a Kavachomer. So what's the Gemara say? What was Rabbi Shimon talking about when he made a Kavachomer? Isur ba'alma. He wasn't talking about imposing Malkus on you if you ate a Chatas and Asham outside of the Beis HaMikdash, outside of the Azara. Rather, what was he doing? What was he saying? He's saying just, it's Usur. Now, of course, something that just a Stam Isur, even without it being accompanied by Malkus, is still pretty bad. But what Rabbi Shimon basically saying is, yes, I understand I can't make a Kavachomer and infer and basically extrapolate Malkus from one prohibition to another violation. But what I could do at very least is use a Kavachomer to infer that if one thing is Usur, the other thing's Usur. Okay, a Kavachomer can't be used to teach that that new Usur thing also incurs Malkus, but enough to tell me that at least it's Usur. Seems reasonable. And according to our logic, now what's the reason you can't use a Kavachomer? To learn that if one thing's Usur, the other thing is Usur. The issue is that you can't rectify giving Malkus or a capital punishment to somebody. But once you go, is everyone frozen? Can you hear me? Everyone's screens froze. I want to make sure you guys can hear me. Someone speak up. Hmm.